Welcome to the ICEF podcast, where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ICEF CEO Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve sits down with journalist Nick Witchell for a conversation focused on what business leaders can learn from this year's major cyber attacks and the recent AWS outage. The two also discuss cyber regulations and the challenge of operating global enterprise during significant geopolitical turmoil.
Steve, we've seen example after example recently of major companies really being brought to their knees by cyber attacks. Why is the message still not getting through? Why are senior leaders still, it would appear, treating this as a compliance issue?
Good question, Nick. I think that for a lot of people, not all, but still for some, we have this hope that it won't happen to us. It's still something that affects other people and we'll take our chances. I think that sort of number is diminishing, but certainly still prevalent amongst the smaller organisations, mid-sized organisations. And that's a really big problem. And the reason for that is the attacks that you're alluding to there, people like Jaguar Land Rover, Collins Aerospace, impacting airports, Marks and Spencers, those attacks have all come through the supply chain. So they haven't directly gone after the large companies. They've gone into the large companies via the supply chain. So I think that there needs to be very much more focus on that aspect of things. Now, in the boardroom itself, in companies themselves, we have seen over the past few years an increasing awareness of the threat that these kinds of things can bring to really the future of an organization. But the challenge I think we now face is really helping boards, senior executives, to transition from, yes, I get there's a threat, but what should I actually be doing about it?
Indeed. So what would you identify as the hallmarks of a board that's doing the right things when it comes to cyber resilience?
I think there's a few things. First of all, they're probably aware, may sound silly, but they need to be aware, so they're showing an interest. And I think that cybersecurity people have worked very hard to demystify some of that. So I think we're making progress in that regard. The second thing is they need to understand that what we're talking about is not just a simple compliance issue. Now, they've levitated towards that because boards understand compliance, they understand risk, they understand their role in that. So it was helpful, I think, in the early days for us to put cyber into that compliance type bucket. But I always say this, good compliance doesn't equal good security. Good security does bring about good compliance. So we need to be focusing more on specifically what we need to be doing to increase our security levels. One of those things is doing the basics. Get the basics right. So the board should be asking, are we doing the basics?
But people like you, people like the ISF, have been saying this for years. So I wonder whether voluntary compliance is still viable, or is it time for a tougher regime, a regime of mandatory cyber compliance?
We're starting to see some of that come in certain parts of the world. Certainly the responsibility of the director, for instance, has changed over the years in this. I still remain a sort of a light touch regulatory compliance legislation kind of person. And the reason for that is that I do fear that when we bring in some form of constraint, compliance, that it prevents businesses going about doing what they're best at doing. And the speed at which the whole environment is changing means that any form of regulation is going to be outdated very quickly. And we know that regulators, legislators are not the best at keeping pace with the speed at which our industry is moving, which with the advent of AI has only accelerated it. I'm all for guidelines, strong compliance, really only where it's absolutely necessary, financial services, health industries, those sorts of areas, and certainly around critical national infrastructure, because we must protect that, because we do know that certain nation states are beginning to chip away at those areas.
The UK government has suggested, or has appeared to suggest, that companies should have fallback positions back to basics, almost metaphorically pen and paper. Do you think that approach should be in the toolkit, as it were?
You know, I don't think it does any harm. You know, if I look at my own organisation, if I look at the ISF, if I look at our business continuity plans, they are on paper. Yes, of course, we've got digital versions of them. But we come from a position that says, if the worst were to happen, the chances of the key individuals being able to access that digitally are pretty slim. And so having it on paper, where you can actually refer to it, is not a bad way to go. So I don't think that I would ever suggest a complete return to pen and paper, but it is pretty effective. If you're looking after it and keeping it safe, it's very hard to hack, and you can rely on it. So I can understand why the NCSC, National Cybersecurity Center, has come out with that. And I think it really is just, I suppose, a sign of the times. You know, we've become so dependent upon technology. We've forgotten that sometimes simple works.
And if your company does fall a victim to ransomware or a data breach, how do you recommend that leaders should go about restoring trust and business continuity?
I think these sort of situations now are becoming all too common. The organizations that are able to come through them still in decent shape, I'm talking about now from public opinion perspective, having preserved minimum viable company, they're the organizations that have invested the time in running cyber simulation exercises from the very top of the company, the board, right the way down. So I think there's more of a need for organizations to rehearse for the day that they hope doesn't happen. Because when it does happen, it is chaos. And it doesn't last for a short period of time. If we look at some of these examples that I mentioned earlier, Marks & Spencer's, Jaguar Land Rover, these have been months. And the cost associated with these things, not just in fixing the attack or the breach, but in the cleanup afterwards and the knock-on effect, is huge. Massive numbers are being bandied about at the moment, particularly with regard to JLR, you know, £1.9 billion. We've not seen that kind of number before. The impact on workforce, people in supply chains being without jobs, losing jobs. So we're talking not just about a financial impact, we're talking about a human impact as well. And we have to really, in our planning, take all of those things into account. And the companies that are able to come through that, having dealt with beforehand in a scenario environment, those sorts of things, and they have to be doing regularly, Nick. I think this is the other thing. It's no good to say, well, we did it 2 years ago. No, you have to be rehearsing this minimum every 12 months. I would probably say slightly more frequently than that, but at least every 12 months. And you have to be viewing it almost in the same way as you view your financial audit. It's just something that you have to do. And I think if we can get to that point, we will, to your original question, really have raised the awareness in the boardroom as to how important this is, not just from a compliance standpoint, but from a business continuity and business survival perspective as well.
The other incident that we've seen recently, of course, has been the outage by Amazon Web Services, AWS, which brought much of the internet to a halt. What lessons do you think we should be taking from the way in which cyberspace is set up at the moment?
This plays back to the comment I was making earlier about our overdependence on technology. I think that in the main, cloud service providers are still probably far better equipped to provide the level of service that most companies need than you'd be able to do yourself. However, we do need to take into account that things will go wrong, and we have to plan for that. So if you're an organization that can quite happily exist without access to data in a cloud provider, it doesn't have to be Amazon, could be anybody else, then fine. I would question why you're using them in that case. If, on the other hand, you are dependent on them, you have to have some backup in place. So again, it's about planning for the things that you hope are not going to happen. But technology fails. We know technology fails. And I think we've fallen into this sort of happy glow, if you like, of, oh, the technology will be there. The reality is that it won't. And so planning for that day, again, I think is hugely important. And depending on which sector you're in, depending on how dependent you are upon some of these things, the plans that you will put in place will be very particular to your own organization. I think that's a very important point because, again, all too often people say to me, you know, what's everyone else doing? Yes, it's useful to understand what everyone else is doing, but what do you need to do? What is important for your organization? And increasingly, we're spending a lot of time working with our members on just unpicking some of that. Where are the crown jewels hiding? How do we need to make sure that they are being protected, accessible in the event such as the one that you're talking about, or in the event of a breach?
There's been a recurring theme through several of your answers, which is that we're depending too much on technology. So just bringing together all those threads, what should businesses be considering doing in order to mitigate the risks?
I think it's about going back to basics. Now, depending on the size of your organization, if you take a bank, for instance, a bank is in a very difficult position. It has a whole host of legacy systems in place where they've been constantly building and building to provide future range of services, changing the way in which they're managing things. I would always recommend people going right the way back and looking at it, again, as I mentioned earlier, around this sort of minimum viable company. Where are my crown jewels? Where are my absolutely essential business assets? How do I access them? How do I keep them secure? What happens if I can't do either of those things? And plan for that. So that's really scaling it back to something that should be, for most businesses, perfectly manageable. So instead of trying to boil the ocean, which a lot of people still try to do, let's bring it right the way back, start there. Then when you're satisfied that you've got that covered, that will be through a range of different exercises that you've gone through. It will have been involving the whole business in terms of identifying those different assets, understanding where they live, retiring them when they're no longer appropriate. Then you can begin to move on to other areas.
That can be challenging at any time. It is surely particularly challenging at a time of global instability, such as we're witnessing at the moment. So how do businesses build resilience of the kind that you're describing at a time of such geopolitical turmoil?
No, absolutely. But never been more important to your point about the instability. You know, a lot of our members, over half of them, are multinational organizations. So they're operating across a range of different countries, jurisdictions, all of which bring their own challenges. And so they have to take all of this into account. So what can they actually do about it? Well, it is about really trying to work out what is essential to them, as I've said. And I think it's about not just doing that in isolation. So they need to be involving the key business leaders across the enterprise. They also need to be involving the key suppliers that they've got in their supply chains. It's not going to be easy, but we've now got enough evidence, surely, for most boards to be able to say, it may be difficult, but it's not going to cost me $1.9 billion to put some of these things in place. It's not going to mean that my supply chain evaporates because there's no work for them. And so the cost or the pain now of going through this and really starting to secure your assets so that your company can continue to provide the services, even in a degraded form while you're going through the attack, that has to be worth the time. It has to be worth the money. And it's not an area where people should be scrimping. Again, all too often, I'm seeing people, particularly in the area of, say, cyber simulation exercises, because, to your earlier point, they're viewing it as a compliance exercise, going for least cost. That, to me, is a bit like saying, I've just moved into an area where I know the burglary rate is quite high. What's the cheapest lock and door that I can get on my front door? It's madness. Not many of us would do it. We would try to work within our budget. We'd try to really figure out, you know, how important things were in our house. That's the mentality we have to adopt. So, yes, you can get some of these things done very, very cheaply, and you can tick a box, but it's not going to help you when things go wrong.
Special thanks to journalist Nick Witchell. We'll be back with the second part of this conversation next week, where Nick and Steve dive deeper into AI and its growing role in cyber.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.